So we're going to take a little tour through lymphoma here, non-Hodgkin lymphoma. A lot to talk about, a lot of new things to talk about. Of course, immunotherapy with bispecifics and CAR T, so exciting. We're going to hear about that in the myeloma session as well. Welcome to our faculty. Great to see you, Sonali and Brad. We have here Dr. Brad Call from the Siteman Cancer Center in St. Louis, and Dr. Sonali Smith from the University of Chicago in Chicago. We're going to start out in a second with Brad talking about CLL and mantle cell, a lot happening there. I was kind of flashing, Brad. I can remember you were at an FCS meeting here. I think it was about 10 years ago. I can remember seeing you stand on the stage, and we were talking about first-line therapy of CLL, and at that time it was like BR, and you were presenting the BR data. And I said, well, I hate to ask you this question, but what would you want if it were you? And he said, well, there's a drug out there called ibrutinib, and frankly, I'd find a way to get it. And I think your prophecy was very accurate. So why don't we just jump into some of the data that you want to review and then get into really where things are heading. Particularly, I think ASH is going to be a pretty interesting experience this year from what I hear in terms of CLL.
So CLL's interesting in that there was about a five-year period where I felt like there was tons of new things to talk about, like every year. But honestly, for the last 2 to 3 years, there's been very little new in CLL. So mostly what I'm going to show you today is just long-term follow-up so your brain can take a teeny breather.
They need it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy for the lung cancer doctors. So anyway, we'll go through some of these long-term follow-ups in CLL. So, you know, it's well established now that the novel agents are superior to chemo immunotherapy in first-line CLL, at least for progression-free survival. And here's a laundry list of all the trials where some sort of novel combination has proven to be better than a immunochemotherapy combination. And when these trials were first designed by the companies, they just wanted approval, right? So they picked sort of a relatively weak comparator, usually chlorambucil, obinutuzumab, and those trials, Illuminate, Elevate, TN, CLL14, easily won, got the approvals. Then the cooperative groups took on some, you know, stiffer competition, BR and FCR. Novel agents still were superior. And then if you look at the very bottom there, the GLOW trial, that's the first example of I'll call it a novel-novel or a pill-pill combination defeating immunochemotherapy. Now, we don't have any approvals right now for these pill-pill combinations of like a BCL2 and a BTK, but I think those are coming, and then we'll have some decisions to make about what's the best time-limited first-line option. So just a couple of words about this long-term follow-up data that Neil asked me to update you all on. So this was the Elevate TN trial. This was the trial that got the acalabrutinib approval, and it was acalabrutinib monotherapy in the middle box there compared to chlorambucil obinutuzumab. But there was this third arm of acalabrutinib and obinutuzumab, with the obinutuzumab given for the first 6 months of the regimen. Again, this was an older treatment-naive patients, and a lot of Kaplan-Meier curves here, but I just want to make 2 points. If you look at the top here, or this top left Kaplan-Meier curve, surprisingly, the obinutuzumab is actually showing a benefit over acalabrutinib alone, the two-drug combination. But honestly, not many people use this. And I'm sure you're like me, when you start a patient on a BTK inhibitor, the real appeal here is the ease and the convenience and the lack of hassle factor. I mean, literally, you can, you know, put the prescription in your electronic medical record ordering system and say to the patient, I'll see you in a month. I mean, it's that easy. And so if you're going to add the anti-CD20, they've got to come back for the infusions and the risk for obinutuzumab infusion. So there are not many people that actually add it despite this positive PFS benefit. Then you might say, well, what about the really high-risk patients? Let's say they are P53 mutated. Should I add the obinutuzumab there? And the data does not support that. It's hard to see amongst all these curves, but buried in here, obinutuzumab acal versus acal alone in P53 mutant got the same result. So I wouldn't use that logic to add the obinutuzumab.
Just to flip over to Sonali, are there situations where you do add obinutuzumab to acal?
No, I mean, I think we're going to get to some of the zanubrutinib data, but I think the ease of practice of just using a BTK monotherapy is very, very appealing. A couple of times that I have considered the obinutuzumab has been really when the patient has, you know, looked at some of this data actually and said, I really want this improved PFS. During the pandemic, of course, and even post-pandemic, I've been very hesitant to add an anti-CD20 if I don't have to.
Brad, do you still have the reluctance about CD20 in terms of COVID nowadays?
Yeah, what the pandemic did for me is it really got me away from prolonged CD20 exposure. For example, I no longer recommend maintenance therapy in frontline follicular lymphoma. It just doesn't seem worth it to me from a risk-benefit standpoint. So if I am giving it, I'm giving it in a time-limited way.
All right, please continue.
So this is the long-term follow-up of the Sequoia study. This is a trial that led to the zanubrutinib approval, and this was single-agent zanubrutinib BTK inhibitor against bendamustine rituximab in older, previously untreated CLL. And you can see the control arm here is performing a little better than chlorambucil G. But what you can see, zanubrutinib is performing extremely well at 3.5 years. 82% of people are still in their first remission. So we're getting long. This was the third BTK inhibitor on the block, and we don't have quite as long a follow-up as we do for, say, ibrutinib and acalabrutinib, but zanubrutinib appears to be performing just as well as the other BTK inhibitors for progression-free survival.
Again, back to Sonali, any thoughts on how do you choose between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib if you're going to use BTK first line?
Yeah, I just had this conversation twice in the last 10 days. And, you know, a lot of it is driven by insurance. Even though zanubrutinib was FDA approved in the frontline setting earlier this year, not all insurance companies are covering it. But, just again, based on the fact that the monotherapy data for zanubrutinib is very promising, that's been sort of my go-to if the insurance will cover it. And then with the acalabrutinib, you always have to have that conversation about what if you add in the obinutuzumab. So, you know, slight preference for this if just based on logistics more than anything.
Same question to you, Brad.
Boy, it's kind of a coin flip. I was actually talking to my nurse practitioner about this week, and we just started going through the Rolodex of patients in our head. So what I'm about to say is not data-driven. Okay. This is just based on observations in my clinic. Acalabrutinib's been around longer, and I had been using it in CLL for many years. Zanubrutinib got approval in mantle cell several years ago, 2019. So now I have 5 years of experience with Zanu in mantle. The CLL approval came later, a couple years ago, and when it did, we started using it. I think I am seeing more patients have to stop Zanu for AEs than I ever saw with ACAL. It's not a huge problem. I would say it's a small problem, but we're getting more hypertension, we're getting more hyperkalemia, we're getting some kidney injury in some of our patients. So if I had to guess, I may be having to stop Zanu maybe, 10% of the time, 15%, some small number. But it wasn't that high with ACAL. So literally this past week, my nurse and I said, in CLL, these little bit of AEs we're dealing with aren't really worth it. Let's just go back to ACAL for CLL. I'm still going to keep using Zanu in mantle because the drugs don't work as well in mantle, and Zanu might be 10% more active. And so I want that increased activity for mantle. But for CLL, I think we're going to start preferentially using ACAL.
Anything you want to add to that? Also, any comments about headache with acala?
Yeah. So the headaches with acala, just to answer that very quickly, do go away with caffeine, and most people, after a couple of weeks, it's, very well tolerated. But I wanted to pick up on something Brad said, which is, with long-term follow-up, just like we saw with ibrutinib, that at 5 years, about, 30, 40% of people cannot stay on. Maybe we'll see that with some of these, second-generation covalent BTK inhibitors. But the one thing about zanubrutinib is, because it is four pills, if I've had to, I can go down to three pills, and I've actually found that to be much better tolerated, so there's a little bit more ability to moderate the dose for zanubrutinib.
I do like that about zanubrutinib, more dosing flexibility.
Yeah.
All right, venetoclax.
Yeah, so this is long-term follow-up from the CLL14 trial. This was the trial that got venetoclax obinutuzumab. at the moment, this is my favorite frontline regimen in CLL because it's 12 months time-limited therapy. You do the obinutuzumab for 6 months, you do the venetoclax for 1 year, and then your patients get a break, which I love it when the patients get a break. So here's 6 year follow-up, defeated chlorambucil obinutuzumab, no surprise. You can see that the ven-obin curve isn't holding up quite as nicely as some of these BTK curves, so we admit that, but you can parse this data out a little more precisely. And where the difference really seems to fall is the IGHV mutated versus unmutated. So recall that mutated has the better prognosis and everything works better in mutated. So 12 months venobin in mutated works just as well as an indefinite BTK inhibitor, it would seem, based on cross-trial comparisons. If you have a patient with IGHV unmutated disease, then it's a conversation. If I put you on a BTK inhibitor, you'll be on it indefinitely, and at 5 years, you have a 75% chance of still being in your first remission. If we do venobin, your treatment is done in 12 months, you have a 50% chance of still being in remission at 5 years. And the patient and I will just kind of talk it through, is that trade-off worth it? Time off therapy for maybe a slightly shorter first remission. And then what about P53? This is, again, cross-trial comparisons. Here's some ZANU data. If you look at ACAL or ibrutinib, it looks similar. The BTK inhibitors, which are given indefinitely, seem to control the disease somewhat better than time-limited venobin if the patient is P53 mutated, either 17p deleted or have a mutation. So this is a scenario, this is the highest risk scenario for CLL, higher risk than being unmutated. So I will recommend a BTK inhibitor to my patients in this scenario. Okay, so just to summarize all that, factors guiding therapy in the frontline. Does your patient prefer time-limited therapy, venobin, done in a year? Does your patient wish to avoid infusions and monitoring? Because venobin is kind of high maintenance in that first 5-6 weeks with all the infusions, the TLS monitoring. BTK is a lot simpler, so you might go that direction. On the other hand, sometimes you have to factor in comorbidities. Is your patient already in AFib and chronically on anticoagulation, and they're 82 years old and they fell last month? Okay, maybe a BTK and their anticoagulation isn't your favorite combo. That might steer you back towards venobin. On the other hand, what if your patient has renal impairment and you are worried about the tumor lysis? That might steer you away from venobin back toward BTK. So you have all these comorbidities and logistical considerations to take into play when you're making that decision. The good news is it's a good problem to have because both therapies work amazingly well. So thinking about the future of CLL, I think the next frontier are what I call novel combinations, like a BTK and a BCL2 inhibitor. And we had a press release this summer from the AMPLIFY trial. I think we're going to see this at ASH. I don't know what the data shows, but I'll show you the press release in a minute. Could MRD assessments guide a rational duration of therapy? And we have some trials like CAPTIVATE and MAGIC that could inform on that. At the moment, we don't know how to use MRD to help us figure out how long to give therapy. And then are there newer targeted agents on the horizon that may perform better? We obviously have a third generation BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib. So just to finish up on CLL, so here's the schema for the AMPLIFY trial, and it was time-limited ACAL venetoclax given for a year. There was a second arm with obinutuzumab, and this was compared against more legit immunochemotherapy, FCR or BR. And what we have learned is that the novel combination, whether it had the obin or not, improved the progression-free survival in this trial. That's all we know at this point, and I think we'll see this data at ASH.
I'm curious, kind of personality's thoughts on that, but first, I noticed the FCR arm was flashing on this patient. I was thinking about you when you when you told me many years ago you wanted to get ibrutinib. There was a patient who was dying to get ibrutinib, so he went on the, I think it was an ECOG trial, comparing it to FCR. Mm-hmm. Was that the ECOG trial?
Yeah.
I always thinking that was amazing randomization to talk about ibrutinib versus FCR. And the patient got randomized to FCR, and the patient said, okay, I'll stay on it. Maybe got cured, but all kinds of secondary effects were miserable from the FCR, kind of interesting. Any thoughts about this? I think it would not be a surprise if this were positive. It sounds like it is. Do you think we're maybe looking at a, it kind of makes complete sense to me, and I think a lot of people, you think that's maybe where we're going to be heading after December?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited to see what this shows. I love that, you know, at least from a design perspective, you know, companies are listening to the fact that we do want time-limited therapy. That, you know, these are the most active agents that we have. And having both a BTK inhibitor as well as the BCL2 inhibitor, you can maybe start to address some of the things like the mutation status and the 17p deleted patients. So I'm really excited to see what this shows.
So in terms of time-limited therapy, Brad, just kind of curious, everybody always brings up the young patient right away, but do you find older patients also prefer time-limited therapy? And also, do you use generally debulk patients before you give them venetoclax, either with an obinutuzumab or maybe with going to be with a BTK moving forward?
So the debulking question, if you give ven-obin, they receive 3 weeks of obin before they start the ven, so usually they have been debulked sufficiently.
And that's the status you use when you determine TLS risk,
yeah.
Once they get debulked.
Right. And so it's very rare that someone's still in the high-risk category and needs to be hospitalized. And with the very cautious venetoclax ramp-up, I can't remember the last time I had to, like, actually deal with tumor lysis syndrome and act on it. It almost never happens.
All right, let's talk about pirtobrutinib. I mean, we got questions about why is pirtobrutinib going to be looked at first line, but anyhow, let's talk about the data.
Right, so pirtobrutinib is now approved for relapsed refractory CLL that for patients who have failed a prior BTK inhibitor. This is considered a third generation BTK. And it's non-covalent, so it comes off and on the molecule, which may improve the pharmacodynamic effect. And it binds to a different part of the BTK enzyme. So the common mutations that make ACAL or ZANU ineffective don't seem to hit pirtobrutinib. So that's why this BTK inhibitor can work in patients who progressed on ZANU or ACAL or ibrutinib. So it was studied in this trial called BRUIN. And the overall response rate in BTK failures is about 82%, so 8 out of 10 patients respond, which is great. And this data here shows the durability of remission, depending on whether they had had prior BCL2 naive, in which the remission duration was about 2 years, and if they're BCL2 exposed, it was more like 16, 18 months. So it is a very nice option to have now, and running into the... We call them now double refractory if you're refractory to BTK and BCL2. And what are you going to do there? Well, it was just go back to immunochemotherapy, but now we have pirtobrutinib, which is a nice option, and we have liso-cel as well, a CAR T-cell therapy.
So now you want to comment on double refractory patients? You think if we start moving into an amplify or you combine strategy, you're going to see this more frequently? And right now, how do you think through therapy, and how do you factor in the patient's age and comorbidities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the novel combinations, because they're time limited, the hope is that even if there's relapse or progression later, that they'll still respond. And I think that's one of the advantages to time limited therapy. I've used a ton of pirto, actually, in the short time it's been FDA approved. It's very well tolerated, and I think it's a good bridge, for patients maybe to CAR T, or at least just giving them a little bit better, duration of response.
Brad, do you see any future of pirtobrutinib in the first-line setting? We were doing a webinar, and somebody in the chat room had a patient with really bad heart disease, a pacemaker, and ventricular huge problems. And they said, can I give him pirtobrutinib? Is it safer in the heart? What's your clinical experience with the drug? How does it compare to the three agents we had prior to this?
Yeah, I think the cardiovascular risk is quite minimal with pirtobrutinib. Definitely safer than ibrutinib, whether it's different than ZANU or ACAL for that, I can't tell yet.
And in terms of sort of annoying quality life issues, arthralgias, et cetera, again, how would you put, you know, ibrutinib, acalazanu, and pirtobrutinib in that? Do we have enough data or clinical experience?
Pirtobrutinib is probably has the fewest side effects, I think. Well, I'm trying to think what I've seen. People can still bruise like crazy on it. And I had maybe one or two patients get bad edema on it. So again, you give it enough, you will start to see some toxicities, but for most patients, very well tolerated.
Mantle cell lymphoma.
Okay, unlike CLL, where not much has changed, this disease, things have changed. So we'll try to update you on what's changing in mantle cell. So for a lot of years, if a patient has been young and fit, we've done some sort of high-dose cytarabine induction, autotransplant and first remission, and maintenance rituximab. And now we have the publication of the TRIANGLE trial, which I think is changing everything. For older, less fit patients, the standard for a number of years has been, you know, BR induction, usually with maintenance rituximab. And then the question before us is, will the ECHO trial, which has been presented but not published, will that change the standard of care? So let's look at these two data sets. So just to remind you, this has been on my mind for several years. The difference between intensive and non-intensive treatment strategies is significant. BR is pretty easy to get through. Maintenance rituximab, pretty easy to get through. Induction HIDAC, not so easy. Got to be hospitalized. You're probably going to need transfusions. The stem cell transplant consolidation is not easy. It's a month in the hospital. It'll take months to feel normal after that. It's like 12 months out of your life to go through all that. And then you go on to the maintenance. But if you have a 64, 65-year-old and you're right on the fence, it's a huge decision. So this has always been a conundrum for me, like how disparate these two treatment pathways are for a patient. So then along comes TRIANGLE. And it's a three-arm study, and up at the top there is arm A, and that was their standard. It's R-CHOP with alternating R-DHAP, autotransplant. And then they started out with observation, but then the data supporting maintenance came into play, and some countries in Europe adopted the maintenance, and some countries did not. So on this trial, some patients got maintenance rituximab, and some did not. A little confusing, but that's the way it was executed. And then there were two arms where ibrutinib was added, so that arm A plus I in the middle, same treatment that I just described, except ibrutinib is added during the R-CHOP cycles, and then for 2 years maintenance after the transplant. And then the third arm at the bottom, just called I, same induction, ibrutinib added during the R-CHOP cycles. The stem cell transplant is actually subtracted, 2 years of ibrutinib maintenance given. So there's an addition question and a substitution question in this trial. Okay, so this was just published in 2024 in May. And up at the top there, both ibrutinib-containing arms improve failure-free survival. The top right-hand curve is ibrutinib plus transplant versus transplant alone. And the middle curve is ibrutinib added, transplant subtracted versus transplant. So arm I and arm A plus I defeated arm A, which was the transplant. Both ibrutinib-containing arms were better. There are not enough events yet to compare arm A plus I to arm I. But if you look at the two curves visually, the green curve and the blue curve, they look pretty much the same. There's definitely more infections in the patients who got autotransplant and ibrutinib. Okay, what do you do with this information? Well, it's been interesting because I've been like talking to everyone I could talk to since we first saw this at ASH 2022. I know some centers flipped immediately. They saw this presentation, they're like, we're stopping transplant, we're gonna start giving a BTK inhibitor. I know some centers who are kind of transplant-centric were reluctant to take away this transplant that we'd been doing for all these years, but they added the BTK inhibitor. I kind of just waited for the publication to make sure there weren't any, you know, curveballs, but there weren't. The paper looked like the presentation, so I have converted this past summer. I am adding the BTK inhibitor, and I am subtracting the stem cell transplant, no longer recommending that. Some of my transplant colleagues say, well, the follow-up isn't that long. You know, we have 8, 10, 12-year follow-up with transplant. I admit that. But talking to people around the country, I do think more and more centers are going to adopt this strategy of subtracting the stem cell transplant and adding the BTK inhibitor. I have no idea what they're doing at the University of Chicago.
Why don't you tell us?
We are a transplant-centric place, and the duration of response after transplant is pretty impressive. You know, I have lots of people who are a decade out and, you know, doing really well, not on any treatment. That all being said, this is a huge area of debate, and we kind of go patient by patient, share some of the data with them. And, you know, adding BTK inhibitors to the initial chemotherapy, especially with the RCHOP, RDHAP, you know, that's also got its own infectious side effects. So I will just say we're on the fence, and maybe in a year from now, I'll give you a more definitive answer.
But. Yeah. So this is kind of where the whole world is at right now, trying to figure out what to do with this. Caveat, ibrutinib was pulled from the U.S. market, so if you're going to do this strategy, you have to substitute in a different BTK inhibitor, and I'm comfortable with that. The NC guidelines just say generically BTK inhibitor. And a big appeal here is if you do it, it's time limited. You do the BTK inhibitor for 2 years and then you stop. I really like that aspect of the design. Okay, so what about this ECHO trial? This is in older mantle cell patients, and this has been a trial that was executed in the last few years and was presented at EHA this summer. So this is for older mantle cell patients over 65 or with comorbidities, not candidates for intensive type strategies. So the control arm in this trial is just straightforward BR for 6 cycles and 2 years of rituximab maintenance. And the experimental arm adds acal ibrutinib in during that induction and then during that maintenance, but then in this trial, the acal is continued indefinitely until either progression or toxicity. Patients on the control arm who progress can cross over to get acal. So we don't know a lot about this because it's not published, it's only been presented, but these are the progression-free survival curves shown at EHA, and you can see there's a modest benefit for the addition of the acal ibrutinib. They say it's a 27% improvement in the median progression-free survival, so that's if you look at the curves this way. Yeah, it is a big difference. I like to look at the curves this way, up and down, like what's the separation? You're about 10% more likely to be in remission at 3 years and 4 years if you take the ACAL. So that's the benefit. There is not an overall survival difference. There's a trend favoring the ACAL, but there are also more COVID deaths in the ACAL arm. I think that tells you something. Being on a BTK inhibitor chronically must be doing something to your immune system that's not great if you're more likely to die of COVID. So if ACAL gets approval in this patient population, older first-line treatment, should you now use it? I think this is a tough call. There's a progression-free survival benefit without an overall survival benefit. The BTK inhibitor is given until PD, meaning you're exhausting it in the front line. That's a problem, although I admit you now have pirtobrutinib. It's a problem because the BTK inhibitors are your best second-line treatment option right now. So this is a tough decision. I don't see myself adopting this strategy if we get the approval. It would have been more appealing to me if it was time-limited BTK. But this is another one of those things where I think you're going to get different opinions from different folks looking at the same data, and reasonable people could differ on the interpretation here.
And then, we did a CME program with Michael Wong, who I think presented the ECHO data a year ago, and a couple weeks later I did a program with you, and I told you what he said to me, and I'm going to tell you what he said to me a couple weeks ago, was that he would like to use, and I think he actually does use, a acal rituximab chemo-free.
Right. So he's sort of already moved on past this. Yeah. And that's just based on some of his own in-house phase 2 data. It's not based on any comparative data.
So any thoughts in general about first-line therapy, Sonali, and what do you think about chemo-free? Is Dr. Wong ahead of his time?
Yeah, I think we need to move to chemo-free just as we have for CLL. I realize it's a different disease, but you know, just to look at the BTK inhibitor, you know, and the COVID deaths, I think what we're finding is that bendamustine is a really, really immune suppressive drug. And I think really that's the problem. Building on a bendamustine backbone has not worked with almost any agent.
All right. Do you want to summarize where we're at?
So transplant may not be necessary if you're adding 2 years of a BTK inhibitor. That's what Triangle is suggesting. For older patients, BR with our maintenance is a good standard of care. We're trying to move past that. Unclear if echo will change it. I do agree with Sony. Chemo-free is the next thing that needs to be tested against standard of care. Why am I saying BTK okay in younger but not older? Because it, to me, it allows the subtraction of the stem cell transplant, and it was time limited. Okay, just two words on relapsed mantle cell. The mainstay of treatment for relapsed mantle right now is either acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, with response rates north of 80% and median durations between 2 and 3 years. Pretty good. But we now have pirtobrutinib. We just talked about pirtobrutinib in the CLL block. It has good activity in relapsed mantle cell lymphoma, with response rates around 50% and response durations in the 18-month range for relapsed mantle that has failed a prior BTK. So it is a nice option to now have for relapsed mantle. There is this trial called Simpatico that was presented at ASH, and it's looking at abrutinib versus abrutinib venetoclax in relapsed refractory mantle cell lymphoma. And what and the venetoclax is given for 2 years, the abrutinib is given indefinitely. And it did show that the two-drug combination was better than the one-drug combination. So this is a really interesting novel combo for relapsed mantle. It's not approved in the U.S. right now, but if we did have the option of giving a BTK plus ven for relapsed mantle, I would be interested in using this strategy for my relapsed mantle patients. So if I have relapsed mantle, I typically start on a BTK inhibitor. If you get a CR, it can be quite durable. If you only get a PR, those tend not to be so durable. So if I have a younger patient, I might start looking at CAR-T, getting that all lined up, ready to go, because when they progress, it can happen fast. The options are not great after CAR-T relapse, but we do have Pirto now, and obviously trials. And then I'll just mention glofitamab, which has some decent activity, and there's a registration trial trying to get glofitamab approval for relapsed mantle. Response rates are nice and high, and durability is respectable. But we definitely need more options for relapsed mantle.
So, Sonali, any comments on post-BTK in mantle cell? Do you use pirtobrutinib as a bridge to CAR-T? What do you see with CAR-T, not just in terms of efficacy, but also tolerability in terms of CRS and neurotoxicity?
Yeah, I think, for mantle cell lymphoma, CAR T cell therapy has a little bit more CRS and ICANS than we see with, with follicular or diffuse large B cell lymphomas. But we do use Pirto in our group as a bridge, have had, really good results. I mean, the challenge with relapse refractory mantle cell lymphoma is that, patients really don't do well, and it's a huge area of unmet need. So, trying to get them to CAR T is important.
Before we go on to diffuse large B-cell and follicular, Brad, any comments in terms of the incidence of mantle cell? And any, I've heard people, Dana-Farber, say they see a lot of it because there are a lot of farmers there and herbicides, et cetera. Is there a regional or correlation with mantle cell?
Exposure to chemicals, herbicides, pesticides seems to increase the risk for lymphoma in general. I don't know if that translates even more to mantle cell. I think at the academic centers we get more mantle because the community docs are a little less comfortable with it, more likely to refer. I just feel like we get a disproportionate proportion of mantle cell patients at academic centers.
Interesting. All right, let's move on and talk a little bit about diffuse large B cell and follicular.
Okay, so I'm going to start with frontline diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, where I think everybody knows R-CHOP has been the standard of care for over 2 decades. And despite a lot of really great studies, building on R-CHOP has not been successful, whether it's adding a BTK inhibitor, lenalidomide, following it with transplant, doing maintenance rituximab. All of these studies have been negative. And just in the last 2 years, we finally had the first positive study, which is the POLARIX trial, which was really, I think, the highest quality type of study we have. It's a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, phase 3 international study. So I think at least in terms of the burden of proof, you know, this is a really well-designed and well-conducted study. Importantly, what it does is it incorporates polatuzumab vedotin, an antibody-drug conjugate against CD79 that releases MMAE, which is a tubulin inhibitor. This was done in high-risk patients, so it was IPI 2 and above. Cell of origin was not a stratification factor, but I'm going to show you a little bit of data about secondary analyses. This was now published 2 years ago, this head-to-head comparison, with a median follow-up of over 2 years. And the primary data has, already been published. And what it shows is that there's a 6.5% increase in progression-free survival and no difference in overall survival. And just a couple of comments, you know, with the median follow-up of 28 months, the vast majority of relapses are going to occur in the first 2 years. So I think this is really promising data, and I hope with time we'll see an improved overall survival advantage. But right now, given all of the options we have in the second and third line setting, I think demonstrating an overall survival advantage may take longer than we think. So one of the sub-analyses they did was, you know, in their initial publication, they had a forest plot that looked at all the different groups, you know, by age, cell of origin, remembering that this was not stratified, it was not stratified by cell of origin. And they published this data right here showing that at least in the ABC subtype of DLBCL, there is a dramatic improvement in outcome when the polatuzumab vedotin is added, and they didn't see that with the germinal center type or the unclassified. And so some people have looked at this and said, well, I'm going to use it preferentially for people who have a non-germinal center DLBCL. And I would just say there's a couple of caveats there. The first is that about 25% of the patients did not have cell of origin assessment even done. And remember that if you use immunohistochemistry to determine cell of origin, there's about a 20% error rate. So I don't know exactly how clean these groups are. It was not centrally determined, and only about a third of patients, so a minority of patients, had the ABC subtype. So I think I personally feel good that I can use this if somebody has ABC, but I wouldn't withhold it for somebody who has a germinal center DLBCL if they have an IPI of 2 or greater. So,
just kind of curious, Brad, do you also go along with that? I mean, you know, some of the questions we got was like, do you only use it with ABC? Also, is cell of origin reliably determined in the community, period?
Well, as Sony said, it's determined by immunohistochemistry, which has a 20% miscall rate. So there's going to be an error rate. I think at our center, if it's an ABC or non-GCB, we're definitely giving our chip pola. If the call is GCB at our center, we're tending to give R-CHOP, but I certainly would not criticize anyone for using R-CHOP polo because the outcomes appear equivalent in the toxicities we're about to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, too, in terms of peripheral neuropathy.
Yeah, so when they looked at the toxicity, it was pretty well balanced across both arms. And, of course, the one that we're interested in the most is the neuropathy because this is an on-target effect of both polatuzumab vedotin as well as vincristine. And what you can see is that, you know, any grade peripheral neuropathy, greater than grade 1, time to onset, time to resolution, discontinuation, and dose reduction are, you know, pretty comparable. And if anything, there was more dose reduction of the vincristine in R-CHOP as opposed to the polatuzumab vedotin. So I think this is, you know, very comparable. So of course, you know, even though this is a great frontline option, and you know, R-CHOP is also still a really great frontline option, relapse refractory disease remains a major challenge. And for decades, we've had autotransplant as a second chance for cure based on the PARMA trial shown here on the left, essentially saying that high-dose chemotherapy can overcome drug resistance, and therefore that became the standard of care. Now, the challenge is that when the frontline therapy improves, such as R-CHOP as opposed to CHOP, the added benefit of an auto transplant really decreases, and you can see that the, you know, progression-free survival goes down quite a bit. And so, you know, we were really kind of in a quagmire, if you will, for patients with needing second-line treatment for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, knowing that autotransplant did not have the same punch as it used to have. So a couple of years ago, we had 3 randomized phase 3 trials that took this head-on and compared CAR T-cell therapy, which had already been approved in the third-line setting, and brought it up to the second-line setting to say, is this better than transplant? And so a couple of things about these three trials. Zuma 7 was for axi-cel, Transform was for lysocel, and Belinda was for tisa-cel. They all looked at high-risk relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, here defined by time to relapse. So they were either refractory to the first-line treatment or relapsed within the first year. And in these head-to-head comparisons, the tisa-cel study was negative. The other two were positive. And, you know, this, again, is data that has been out there for a while and really established CAR T-cell therapy as the second-line option for high-risk relapse refractory DLBCL. What we have that's new is that we have some long-term follow-up. Does this hold up with time? And so just this past year, or in the last, 14 to 18 months, we've had two long-term publications. So Zuma 7 with a median follow-up now of 47.2 months, there is not only an improved progression-free survival, but actually an overall survival difference. And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and I think really cements CAR T-cell therapy as the standard of care for second-line DLBCL for those patients who can get it. For the TRANSFORM study, the median follow-up is now around 3 years. And again, the event-free survival has continued to be superior for the CAR T-cell arm, 29.5 months versus 2 months for auto transplant. And the 3-year PFS has not even been reached. Overall survival at this point is the same. So what this has done is really give us a new algorithm for how we approach DLBCL in the relapse and refractory setting. We have to look at the timing of relapse. Is it within a year or not? And the fitness of the patient. And, you know, for auto transplant, we have to have a couple of things. We have to have patients who are fit for transplant. We have to successfully be able to collect their stem cells. And we have to have chemosensitive disease, because if they're not in a CR, transplant doesn't help at all. And so for those patients who are not fit, surprisingly, CAR T-cell therapy works just as well. And so lysocel, for example, is approved for older patients with relapse refractory DLBCL as well. So of course, CAR T-cell therapy is not available everywhere. And particularly in the third line setting, we have other options. And so there's a number of things that have been FDA approved. We have polatuzumab with BR. We have selinexor. We have tafasitamab with lenalidomide. This is an enhanced anti-CD19 monoclonal antibody. We have loncastuximab tesirine, which is an antibody drug conjugate that has a PBD dimer payload, which is essentially a DNA damaging agent. And then just in the last 12 months, we've had two bispecific agents that are CD20 by CD3 FDA approved. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the data for the bispecific agents. So epcoritamab is against CD20 by CD3, and it has some point mutations in the Fc domain that improve persistence and perhaps decrease toxicity. And then glofitamab has this really interesting, has two different elements that bind CD20 in addition to CD3. And this one has a silent Fc that, again, also is there to help mitigate some of the toxicity. Epcoritamab is subcutaneous, and glofitamab is IV. So if we look at the EPCO data, this was the original phase 1-2 data that was presented. I just want you to focus on the patients who were enrolled in the study. So these, you know, were heavily pretreated patients who had relapsed and refractory disease. 76% were refractory to at least two lines of treatment. 40% had prior CAR T that did not work, and 75% of those CAR T patients had a disease that progressed within 6 months. And so in that population, you can see the waterfall plot as well as the Kaplan-Meier curves showing, two things in my mind. One is that there is a high response rate. The second is that there appears to be a suggestion, at least, of a plateau on the curve. And of course, more follow-up is going to be very helpful. That follow-up was presented at ASH last year, where now we have about 20 months of follow-up, and it does seem like it's holding up, at least in some patients. And I'll just say that CR is very important, so those patients who have a complete response to the bispecific seem to have the best outcome. One thing I did want to comment is that epcoritamab, you know, and all the bispecifics, you know, they have the toxicity of cytokine release syndrome, not so much ICANS in the lymphoma population, but it requires a lot of steroids. And so for epcoritamab, for example, you do have to use dexamethasone for 4 days with each dose, particularly in the first cycle. And the schedule is that it's weekly for the first 4 months, every other week for the next, 6 months, and then once a month indefinitely. So this is an indefinite therapy, and there's a lot of steroids, particularly in the initial cycle. Glofitamab is given IV, and this is the long-term data here. This one, there's a couple of advantages here. This is fixed duration. It's only 12 cycles. The other interesting aspect is that obinutuzumab is used to mop up any CD20 that might be floating around. This helps decrease the risk of cytokine release syndrome. And again, there is a little bit of a complicated first cycle with some step-up dosing that is there to decrease some of the toxicity. And what we see with the follow-up, longer follow-up just presented at ASH about a year ago, is that with about 3 years of follow-up, the most important thing is to have a CR at the third cycle. Now, how we use this data in practice, I think, is, you know, to be determined. But in my mind, if somebody's in a complete remission at three cycles, that's fantastic. I'll continue the whole year. If they're not in a CR, I'm going to start looking for alternative treatments. And then odronextamab is not yet FDA approved, so I just want to put that out there right away. But this is another bispecific against CD20 by CD3. And I just want to, in the box to the right, just looking at the patients who were enrolled, this was probably a more representative trial in terms of patient population. There are underrepresented populations that are included. They had extended screening windows, you know, to help address some of the access restraints. And the eligibility included patients with HIV, hepatitis, and comorbidities. And so this was a slightly older population. Median age was 67. A quarter of patients were over 75. And patients were heavily pretreated, with 86% being refractory to their last line of treatment. Again, complicated step-up dosing, especially for the first cycle. And there's a lot of steroids that are included with this, with dexamethasone being required. But the data looks, you know, I think at least we see some really good activity with median follow-up now of about 2 years. And I just like, I always am so impressed when I think about 5 years ago, relapse refractory DLBCL, you expected a 6 to 12 month survival, and that was kind of it. So now to have some of these prolonged survivals for non-CAR-T and to see that there are patients still doing well, particularly if they have a CR, I think is just really encouraging.
Quick question to Brad. How do you interface with community-based general medical oncologists in terms of bispecific? We're going to talk about this with follicular as well. And where do you see that heading in the future? Do you see it moving out into the community?
I do, and I think it should. You just have to get comfortable with the CRS management, which for these drugs, it's actually not that hard. I mean, I just send my patients home with some dexamethasone pills to take if they get a fever. And I can keep 90% of people from having to go to the ER just by doing that. And the ICANS is really uncommon with these. So yeah. I do think these are drugs that can easily be administered in the community.
Do you yourself like start the patients and then transfer them back?
If the doc wants that, I'm happy to do that. We can get it started, get them through that high-risk first cycle, and then have them go back to finish it out.
So how about STARGLO?
Yeah, just to, can I pick up on what he did, sure. Brad was just saying? So, you know, I think giving bispecifics in the community, there was a publication in Blood just a couple of months ago, a number of people from Lymphoma Research Foundation and NCCN, and there's guidelines for how to give bispecifics safely, you know, and what's required is that you have to have 24/7 access to emergency care, to tocilizumab on hand. Consider sending the patient home with dexamethasone. And I think, as we heard in the lung cancer, you know, discussion, having a caregiver, you know, somebody to observe the patient is really important. But I think it's very feasible. But what we've seen now with the bispecific agents that makes a lot of sense to me is to really combine it with some chemotherapy and see, you know, so this was a really interesting study that was just presented, hasn't yet been published, but it's essentially looking at whether or not you can avoid transplant altogether, even in the late relapses. Okay, so this is not just the early relapses where CAR-T is the standard of care, but let's say somebody's 2, 3, 4 years out and they have a relapse, you know, do you always have to do an auto in that setting? And this was a randomized trial of GemOx with or without glofitamab, and the primary endpoint is overall survival. And with a median follow-up of about 20 months, the overall survival curves actually are separating. So I am really excited to see what the final publication here looks like. But I think this could be, you know, really interesting for late relapsed DLBCL. The other, just kind of going away from bispecifics and CAR T for a second, there are other options for patients. So tafasitamab and lenalidomide, we now have their final five-year analysis. And, you know, this is a time-limited treatment for the lenalidomide portion. The tafasitamab does continue. But for those patients who have a CR, there are some really impressive durable responses. And, you know, this is something where you don't have to admit. You don't have to have tocilizumab on hand. And, you know, the main toxicities are related to the lenalidomide, particularly in the first year. And you can see the overall survival curve separate by the depth of response to the right. The other agent that's available is loncastuximab tesirine. So remember, this is the ADC against CD19. So long-term follow-up for this was recently presented as well. This was published in Hematologica earlier this year. And this agent, it is a delivering chemotherapy, so cytopenias are the major toxicity. There's also an asymptomatic increase in GGT. But again, what you can see is that there are some patients, particularly in a CR, who can have a durable response. And I think if cell therapy or bispecific agents aren't available, you know, this is a very reasonable drug. And I've used this actually in a couple of people who have deferred more intensive therapy. This is the long-term outcome. Now this shows the overall response rate, you know, has been maintained. And you can see the PFS at 1 year and at 2 years, you know, essentially showing that if you have a CR, the outcomes are significantly better than those patients who have a PR.
Brad, any comments on your experience with Lonca-T, both in terms of efficacy and tolerability?
Yeah, the nice thing about Lonca-T is it's off the shelf, and if you have a patient who's really in a jam, they have relapsed disease, they're in pain, they need immediate relief. If the drug works, it starts working immediately. You can give it, you know, that day. It's a 30-minute infusion. And then it's just once every 3 weeks. So that part is all good. The toxicities are not trivial. I mean, this is a chemo drug, and it has some unique toxicities. The photosensitivity is significant. I've seen some horrific rashes in patients who got sun exposure, so you have to be super careful about that. And this can cause a very relentless capillary leak syndrome where patients are getting just a relentless third spacing of fluids that goes on for months. So you have to be super careful if you start to see that. I would stop giving the drug.
How aggressive are you about sun exposure?
Super aggressive. You know, wear a long shirt, wear a big hat, just don't do it.
Interesting. All right, follicular lymphoma.
All right. So for follicular lymphoma, you know, this toolbox has been growing. And, you know, unfortunately, unlike DLBCL, where I showed this nice little algorithm, we don't have that in follicular lymphoma. We just kind of have this, you know, toolkit, and we can kind of reach in and, you know, pick what we want for a variety of reasons. There are some new FDA approvals in the bispecific antibody realm, and I'll go over that, as well as a BTK inhibitor, which I think surprised some of us. So anyway, one of the things that I'm really excited about, and we're going to see this hopefully at ASH, there was a press release looking at, you know, so R-squared, lenalidomide and rituximab is a very standard option, either in the frontline setting or in the second line setting for follicular lymphoma. You know, it's time-limited treatment, and, you know, it's well-tolerated. We all know sort of the side effects to expect from lenalidomide. So tafasitamab, remember, is a glycoengineered anti-CD19 monoclonal antibody. And the question here is whether or not adding that to R-squared, so now having a CD19 and a CD20 along with lenalidomide would be better. And so this, all we know is that the primary endpoint of investigator-assessed PFS was met. It's a large trial, and so I think the questions I have is, you know, what is the value of a dual anti-CD19, anti-CD20, and who were included in this population, you know, were they relapsed or refractory? So I'm excited to see what this shows. So going on to some of the agents that are already FDA approved, mosunetuzumab is a bispecific antibody, CD20 by CD3. And this was FDA approved now about two or three years ago. This is given IV, although a subcutaneous formulation is being assessed. This is fixed duration, and what's really nice about this is that you give 8 cycles, and if patients are in a CR, you're done. If they're not, you go on to complete a total of 17 cycles, and then you can stop. And again, the patients who are included in this, it's kind of small down there, but, you know, these were patients with follicular lymphoma who had very refractory disease, and in this case, double refractory, which is to both an alkylating agent as well as an anti-CD20. So in this population, here's the three-year follow-up. And again, you can see the PFS to the left and the overall survival on the right. Again, there are some people who have durable responses with this time-limited therapy. And out of all of the bispecific agents, I do think mosunetuzumab is pretty easy to give. Most of the toxicity is in the first cycle with cycle 1, day 1, and cycle 1, day 15, which is when the dosing actually increases a little bit. And the onset of the cytokine release syndrome, you know, can be, it's not immediate necessarily, so this is the other important practical tip, is that it can happen 24 to 48 hours after they get treated. So they're going to be home, it's going to be Saturday night, and that's when they're going to have their fever. So this is, you know, just an important thing to advise patients about and be prepared for. Epcoritamab is also now FDA approved, and this was based on the pivotal NHL-1 study. And again, they looked at patients with a median age of 65, high-risk CLIPI scores, three prior lines of treatment, early progression of disease, double refractory, primary refractory, and they also used the stepped-up dosing with dexamethasone 15 milligrams given with every dose, particularly in the first cycle. But what's really exciting is that there was activity across all the subgroups. So whether or not patients had double refractory disease, early progression of disease, 3 to 5 lines of therapy, there was activity that was seen. And with this optimization and the heavy steroids, the likelihood of cytokine release syndrome actually was quite manageable. And the need to use tocilizumab was reduced significantly when you have this. And then odronextamab, again, not yet FDA approved, but, you know, was looked at, again, in a very high-risk population. And the results right here, you know, show that in this very heavily pretreated group of patients, and again, I think this is maybe more of a real-world group, those patients who have a CR, you know, had a much better progression-free survival. We're not seeing the plateau on the curve the way we did with some of the other agents, and I don't know if that's just that it's such short follow-up, and maybe the CR patients will eventually have that plateau, but it's something that we can keep an eye on.
So I think we're going to move on now and talk about multiple myeloma. Thank you both so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thanks.